This is the audio file for the section on the history and evolutionary development of approaches to Australian Catholic school religious education since the 1950s. Firstly, there's a need to recognise that this is a pretty large, rather mammoth section, and others of course will be shorter. So what you need to do to handle all the material in this section is first of all have a skim approach to it to get an idea of where the whole thing goes, and then you can read parts of it in more detail, and not all of the follow-up readings need to be looked at in any detail. What you need to do in working your way through the approaches that appear at different times in the history is to build up a clear, precise picture of the characteristics of the approach at that time and how that fitted in with ideas about religion and society at the time, and then to see when a different approach emerged, what was the really significant change, the really big difference, the key thing that happened here that made such a difference to the way religion was taught. The first part of the section material more or less describes the different approaches that appeared, and remember that they were not all watertight or completely separate, that as one thing emerged it would fit in and merge with what was happening before, so that you never had any one pure approach, but usually a mixture that depended very much on the idiosyncratic approach of the individual teachers. But still you can see that by looking at the different approaches described, you can pick up the significant differences that have emerged over the period. You don't really understand just how extensive and far-reaching and such a quantum leap has occurred in the changes in approach unless you appreciate how they parallel changes in Catholic religious practice and spirituality. So just for fun, you might have a look at the universal 1960s what sort of a Catholic are you test, where you can keep your own scores and draw the conclusions from the test. Just a fun way of identifying some of the characteristics of Catholicism at that time and how they have changed so much since then. If some of the questions you don't even understand or know, well, that will highlight even further the significance of the change. Also, there's an optional short reading developed by a colleague, Dr. Graham English, with his own illustrations. He summarised in very broad strokes the development of Catholic schools in Australia since their origins mainly in the 19th century. We have already talked about the value of getting this big picture, panoramic view of how and why things have changed so much in Catholic school religious education, so there's no real need to repeat that here. So we begin with a look at the catechism approach, say in the 1950s and early 1960s, and the significant point to make is that this approach was somewhat similar to what had been happening for centuries. You think of that, for centuries, and then within a few years, within 10 years around Vatican II, most of that disappeared. And you can see that that was the very first significant period of change. So to get some idea of what the authoritarian catechism knowledge emphasis approach was like, firstly I'd like you to have a look at the video that illustrates some of the texts that have been used. Sheehan's Apologetics, the Old Green Catechism, the Bible History, and so on. And that will give you an idea of the approach to teaching. The Old Catechism had these main sections, Creed, you know, the great core teachings of the Christian faith, the commandments, sacraments, and prayers. And there was a lot of attention given to the memorization or rote learning of the answers, as well as to set prayers. little or no attention was given to a study of the Bible as such, but rather to Bible history, as you will have seen in the video. And all of this was consistent with the approach to Catholic spirituality and religious practice. It was pretty authoritarian. It was very clergy and church-centered, not so individualistic. And there was an element of fear in it all, that you needed to save your soul and you had to be fearful of sinning or doing anything wrong that might endanger your immortal soul. There were school retreats at that time, and one of the optional readings gives a description of what the old retreats were like compared with the new style of communitarian retreat that started in 1964, before Vatican II had finished. The old retreats were very much like the retreats in religious orders and for the clergy. It was all about being silent, being totally by yourself, praying and experiencing religious experience and reviewing your relationship with God. Whereas the new style communitarian retreats were all about friendship, communication, discussion, praying together, celebrating Eucharist together, having time away from normal life, which was typical of the old retreats too, but in a very different way, with friends or with new acquaintances. Now, there is no need to go into the study of retreats in great detail, unless you're interested, so we'll just leave it at that for that brief comment about the new style retreats that followed up in the mid-1960s. And the text summarises some of those characteristics of the catechism approach. Next, we come to have a look at what was called the kerygmatic approach, which appeared in Australia just prior to and in the early stages of the Second Vatican Council. And this comes from mainly from a number of Jesuits, particularly the Jesuit Joseph Jungmann, a German, in 1936, who had pointed out that the catechism really was a very old-fashioned and authoritarian and very unrelated to the life experience of children. And so he drew a lot on the theology that was interesting at the time, concerned with salvation history, or announcing the good news of Jesus. And the word kerygmatic came from the Greek words meaning kerygs, a herald, and kerygma, a message. So it was given special attention to that approach. That would have been a kerygmatic theology. Have a look at the video which shows the new catechisms, the new Australian catechisms that were published in the 1960s. The really significant thing to note in this approach was the renewed prominence, well, there hadn't been there before, a new prominence given to a study of the scripture and in relating the scripture to people's spirituality and their ordinary lives. Have a look through the text talking about the kerygmatic approach, and note that there were some difficulties where excessive attention was given to particular biblical stories, the stories of the great heroes of the faith. And you can see one of Graham English's cartoons depicting a young person at the time saying, "If I hear one more word about Abraham, I'll scream." And some of that sort of thing did happen. Nevertheless, the kerygmatic approach was a very significant milestone for Australian Catholic school religious education, with its new special emphasis on the scripture and on relating it to life. The next approach that we will look at is called the life-centred and or experiential approach. And this came in during the 1960s, the late 1960s, just after Vatican II. And it's difficult to say that this approach was caused by one particular factor, but rather by a whole network of factors. For example, in education, you had Jerome Bruner with his very significant book called Towards a Theory of Instruction, which outlined the whole approach to learning from your own experience, learning firsthand. And it was talked about as discovery learning, which became very prominent in the sciences and geography and so on, but also in English literature and history and so on, where, for example, in history, where it was not just a matter of learning facts and dates, but helping young people appreciate historical perspective and the theories of history and how historians worked. Also, it was affected by the Second Vatican Council. Also, it was affected by psychology and sociology. It was also affected by the rather negative reactions of the students in Catholic schools, who more or less were not going to listen anymore to an authoritative catechism-like approach. So pause the audio and have a look at the video concerned with some of the resources that were used for Catholic school religious education at the start of this period, particularly in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And also in that video, some of the controversy over the Year 11 and 12 catechism called Come Alive, how that occurred, and it is still a controversy that is there today, where some people want to have approaches that were much more authoritative, like in the 1950s, and they tend to blame religion teachers for the decline in church membership and so on. I think we have this issue was taken up elsewhere, but certainly I think an inappropriate criticism, but it is still one that surfaces from time to time today. You will see when you get to the text that a number of factors that I've mentioned before have had an influence. The one that I want to comment on here is the emergence of a more psychological spirituality for both Catholics and other Christians at that time. For Catholics, you had a number of religious personnel who became very skilled in psychology and in sociology, and in a sense they blended the insights from these human sciences with the best insights from the study of scripture and theology, and this informed the prayer, the liturgy, the spirituality of people, and it became a much more relationship-centered spirituality than before, a more humanistic spirituality. And I would argue that this became the dominant style of spirituality for Catholicism in Australia, and it still remains the case, even though from time to time you have more stress on authority here and there, but the core spirituality of most Australian Catholics is of that type. Now, there is a link to a text that describes that spirituality in more detail later in this section. You don't necessarily have to follow up on all of these elements that are put in as additional optional reading, but you could follow up on that spirituality if you wished. So the crucial change in this more experience-centered approach meant it often started with the human experience of individuals. It sought to try to make the teaching of religion both meaningful to the lives of young people and relevant to them. So later, when talking about the meaning and significance of these approaches, the theme personalism and relevance were taken up, because so much was done at this time to try to make it personal and to try to make it relevant. And as we'll see, the efforts to do this were not always fruitful. This quest for personalism and relevance went very well in the New Style retreats, but somehow it didn't work well in the classroom. And as will be discussed later, it's because classrooms seem to be primarily about studying, learning, critical thinking and so on. And if you have something that's all about just discussing what you think and feel, in the long run, this is going to be dismissed by students as of little consequence, because it would just not measure up as a learning area by comparison with the subjects that really count. Have a look at the commentary there talking about potential problems with the experience or life-centered approach, particularly where there was excessive, relatively uninformed discussion, the suggestion being that it was not really discussion that would be most meaningful and helpful for the students, but rather informed debate. The next area that we will look at is an approach to religious education that was called liberational or social justice oriented. And there had been a strong motif for this in the writings of the popes even prior to the Second Vatican Council and after. But it was all about looking into justice issues and by having people well informed and thinking about the issues that they themselves would have a greater personal freedom. The approach here was very gospel-centered, very much concerned with the way that Jesus in the Gospels was concerned with making life more meaningful and more spiritual for the little people, those who were marginalized by the systems of the time. In having a look at the text, you'll note that reference is made to the shared Christian praxis approach, which does fit in under the heading of a liberational approach, and this was developed by the Irish-American Thomas Groom, who published this book, Sharing Our Story, Christian Religious Education, in 1980. This approach was initially something intended for voluntary adult Christians who already had a commitment to and a knowledge of their religious tradition. But it was adapted to the classroom because the big United States Catholic publisher Silver Burdett offered Tom a package that he couldn't refuse to convert this into a school curriculum, which he did. And the approach became very popular in Australia, particularly centred on the Diocese of Parramatta and some other dioceses where the Parramatta guidelines called Sharing Our Story became very popular and used and adapted by some other dioceses. And I think there may still be some dioceses that are using the shared Christian praxis approach. There's no scope here for entering into a detailed evaluation of this because all of the approaches offer something. All of them probably have some potential drawbacks or difficulties. And my reading of it is that the real difficulty is in adapting a voluntary adult small group where the people meet precisely because they are committed to their tradition and because they want to deepen their personal faith. When you apply that to a compulsory classroom with 25 young people in it with a comparatively secular spirituality these days, that you would need to modify the approach somewhat and avoid any problematic assumptions that a highly religious, highly committed pedagogy might seem to take. A comment is also made in the text after looking at the shared praxis approach to the way that personal development and values education entered in some way into Catholic school religious education. Then the next section talks about the emergence of what has been called a subject-oriented understanding of classroom religious education. In other words, all of the gains from the previous approaches were retained. It was not so much dismissing those, but the overall structure and trajectory for religious education was to have it regarded as a credible, meaningful academic subject in the curriculum that suffered nothing by comparison with what was done in the other learning areas. And you will see in Catholic diocesan documents that they moved gradually towards this position in the 1980s and 1990s, so that where the ordinary curriculum had outcomes and assessment rubrics and reporting, So too they would have this in religious education. And so the general mentality that tended to go with this subject-oriented approach was to see that this is primarily education, it is not primarily religious experience, it is not religious sermon, it is an educational exploration of the religious faith tradition in the very best of the tradition that classrooms can keep to. They're all about open, inquiring study, and these days that would include things like student research, use of the internet for inquiry and so on. So this was the slant that was taken in the emergence of this subject-oriented approach to Catholic school religious education. Some authors have talked about this approach and they've called it an educational approach, contrasting it with what were called the more catechesis-like or catechetical or presuming all were card-carrying Catholics or were regular church-going students. That was the assumption in approaches that were said to be catechetical, and this was called the educational approach. I think this is not a good name for it because it tends to give the impression that the previous approaches were not educational, and some of them were. And certainly, even when the catechism was being taught, the teachers felt that this was educating young people with the best knowledge and procedures at the time, and probably you could say that chemistry and physics and maths were taught in a very catechism-like style as well. I can remember myself, one teacher whose whole approach to social studies was questions and answers, and we had to write out over the course of the year when we were 12 the question and answers to all of the topics in social studies, and it ended up being a very, very comprehensive catechism of social studies by the time we were finished. But anyway, with that gone, you had this more subject-oriented approach, which I think is now the relatively mainstream or dominant approach to thinking about Catholic school religious education. I think, as may be discussed elsewhere, that one of the real problems that we are encountering at the moment is that the authorities have moved, I think, backwards into thinking more about religious education as an exclusively ecclesiastical activity, all about church activity, church life, rather than an education in the faith tradition. And I think that's a backward step. I've given my reasons for this. Not everyone will agree with that. But my own view is that the subject credibility of religion in the Catholic school curriculum is possibly sliding backwards a bit because too much of the language and expectations have been shifting in an ecclesiastical rather than in an educational direction. And my own view is that there needs to be creative tension between the two, and that primarily schools are about education, and if the activity is made too ecclesiastical, I think it is going to founder and be regarded as not particularly relevant for the students. Anyway, that's an issue that is considered somewhat elsewhere. The next section in the text points out that the emergence of state-based religion studies courses, where the study of religions, not just Catholicism, but they tended to be more concerned with world religions, following what happened in the United Kingdom in the 70s and 80s. But these courses became accredited just like ordinary subjects in the final 2 years of schooling that counted towards university entrance. And this had a significant impact on the academic credibility of religious education where this was taken up. And the evidence suggests that the Catholic schools, more than any other school system in the country, took up these religion studies courses with great enthusiasm. Some of the clergy were not really convinced that this was a good idea because they felt, well, they're studying other religions and so we just want them to be concentrating on Catholicism. And so that argument is still one that's not resolved for some clergy, but I think so far the Catholic school systems have been able to maintain their commitments in this area, and they haven't been told to drop out of religion studies, although I think this happened in Western Australia, where the church eventually opposed the development of a general state-based religion studies course, and they tended to stick with more Catholic-oriented curricula. And so you have things like Catholic studies, even in some states, particularly in New South Wales, as an accredited but not a subject that really counts in the curriculum. And as I think may have been discussed elsewhere, that the perception of the students is that this one really doesn't count, and this is where the credibility of the subject status of religious education tends to be compromised. Now, within the development of state-based religion studies courses, two approaches emerged, one called the phenomenological and the other one which was called typology, which really is a sub-branch of phenomenology. And these are studied in more detail. They could be taken up for a whole section of study if we had time, but all that I need to point out here is that these were the approaches, well, particularly phenomenology was developed in the United Kingdom as a safe non-church, or as they said, non-confessional approach to religious education, which was judged to be appropriate in the public schools. Unfortunately, with these words confessional, which was described as what happens in church schools, and non-confessional, a more educational approach in state schools, you had unrealistic presumptions, as if, well, everything that's done in a church school is like indoctrination, where they just concentrate only on their own tradition and on nothing else. And of course, that's not true. Often in the public forum of the classroom in church schools, including Catholic schools, because it is a public educational forum, you can't indoctrinate. You shouldn't just push one particular religious view. And so educating children in their own religious tradition may well be, if you look carefully at what the teachers actually say and do, it may well be what's called an impartial, non-confessional approach to the teaching of religion. So I'd like to draw attention to the real problematic nature of this division, confessional and non-confessional, because they apply well to the context. A state school is a non-confessional context. A church school is a strongly confessional context. It's committing and confessing to a particular faith tradition, but this doesn't have absolute control over the approach to teaching, which often may well be impartial and objective, no matter what the context. So that's why I suggest that we be very careful about the way that those words confessional and non-confessional are approached. My suggestion is you just keep that to talk about context, not to approach to religious education. There's a link to Professor Terry Lovett's book where he describes phenomenology, and in the same chapter he also describes the typological approach, which was one invented by a South African and a United States scholar working in Adelaide, and it came out in a book in 1981 called When Religion Goes to School. And it was all about the open phenomenological study of religion under the categories called types. For example, religious stories, or religious persons, or religious dress, or sacred space, or moral codes. So it used all these different categories. The interesting thing is that both phenomenology and its subcategory typology were essentially descriptive and analytical. They're all about describing religion in great detail under various categories. The seven categories or dimensions of religion proposed by Professor Ninian Smart for phenomenology, and the various typological categories proposed by Basil Moore and Norman Harbel. Professor Lovett took up the typological approach, and he tacked on a more critical evaluative dimension at the end, very similar to shared Christian praxis, which had a strong evaluative dimension to it, and you'll see something about that in that article if you wish to follow up on this particular area. It is probably more relevant to those teaching year 11 and 12 religion than to others. The next section just briefly notes some other aspects of the evolution of Catholic school religious education in terms of other dimensions, other spiritual dimensions to what was happening in the schools at the time. Now that concludes the description of all the different approaches to Catholic school religious education that have evolved since the 1950s. The next part of this whole section tries to pick up on some key themes, and these are taken up under five different themes, and then they're looked at in the light of the spirituality and needs of contemporary children and young people today. So what is being attempted in the text here is to say, well, what does all that change mean? What are the really significant developments that we need to hang on to? What are some of the key themes that have appeared in that evolution? And where to from here? What are some of the things we might need to keep in mind when progressing into 21st century Catholic school religious education? So that's the thrust of the remaining text in this whole section. And it's suggested right at the start that we need social and intellectual conditions that will actually give us the capacity to make evaluative judgments about religious education, about what is appropriate. It's so amazing to look back at what happened in the early 1960s, and from our position of wisdom in the 2000s, you can say, oh, we can easily see what was wrong. We can easily see what could have been done better. Why did we not see that at the time? Somehow or other, given the cultural wisdom and the experience and the ideas of the people at the time, they just were not able to put things into the same perspective that we would be able to today. So I think we're in a position now where there's no need for any new gurus, no need for any new approach that's going to revolutionise things. All that we need is just wisdom in the light of that experience to identify and continue with the things that we know are really valuable and useful, and to be aware of any problems with excesses, giving too much attention to something and not enough to others. So I think that's the position where we are today. Now, we begin this discussion of the meaning and significance of the change by simply looking at a big list of all the potential factors that have had a bearing on religious education over these years. Things like theology, movements in religious education, changes in education, changes in psychology and sociology, the changing context, the changing numbers of people in religious orders and lay involvement, diocesan structures and syllabuses, student texts, state religion studies courses, and then the spirituality and the needs of the students themselves. So that's just a list of all the factors, and you can see we're now going to take up a discussion of the meaning and significance of this change under those five themes. The first theme is the quest for personalism and relevance. In the 1960s and early 70s, this was a type of mantra or catch cry for those who were involved in the change from the old catechism approach through the kerygmatic, through to the life experience and experiential focus in religious education, with the new change in spirituality to something that was much more personal and much more psychological and much more relationship-centered. You know, like you can't be a good person by yourself. There was the unwritten mantra was, we are questing for a personal and a relevant religious education. We don't want it to be just all the catechism stuff that had no bearing or relationship on people's lives, and we want it to be the sharing of personal insights, and we want it to be meaningful. Now, it's suggested there that this language of psychological spirituality that I spoke about previously, if you don't understand that, you don't really understand how and why there was such a great stress on personalism and relevance. So if you've got time and you're interested, look at the part of the reading from chapter 8 from the book Reasons for Living, which is linked into the text. Not all of it, but just that part that looks again at that psychological spirituality that became the mainstream Catholic spirituality since the early 1970s. I think the point that I could make is if personalism and relevance in religious education are still valued so much, and I would think they're even more important now in the 2000s than they were in the 60s and 70s, well then what went wrong with this experience-centered approach, trying to make it personal, trying to make it relevant? Why did it fall apart? I think the principal reason is that it was not a challenging academic study, which really needs to be the ground basis, the core, in which a meaningful and relevant religious education is based. People who suggest it has to be personal or academic, I don't think they really understand that you can have a really valuable personal study in the classroom only if it comes from an academic study, because if it is just about discussion and airing your own personal views, it ends up, no matter how good this idea is, it ends up being regarded as irrelevant, as being Mickey Mouse. A similar thing happened in the United Kingdom, where they tried to have PSME, or personal, social and moral education sections of the day, where the students were allowed to talk about all sorts of issues, and it just became a talk fest of no significance. In other words, if it's not based on serious research, serious study, and on informed debate rather than discussion, it never really cuts ice with students as an acceptable subject in the curriculum. And they also come to religion often with a negativity about religion that comes from the culture, from their home spirituality. So the people teaching religion are really up against it in terms of getting students to engage. And no matter what they do, there may always still be this relative negativity, even in studies like religion studies, studies of religion and so on, where it's like, well, this is the religion that we've got to do. So that's the point that I am trying to make here, that the need for personalism, to have it in the classroom, it needs to be regulated by a code of ethics, that people should never be feeling pressure to make personal disclosures about their own personal faith and so on. So if you have a code of ethics, and that is examined in some other sections in units, you have a situation where people then feel free to share their own views if and when they feel comfortable with that. So that's not an issue. But you don't judge the success of classroom religious education by the number and the intensity of personal disclosures. Those who do this, I think, are emotional vampires, and it would be more their own need for sharing at a very personal level with students rather than something that's a natural part of the educational process. So my suggestion is the best core basis, tapestry or baseline or substrate for a meaningful, a personal and a relevant religious education is with a serious academic study. But then, of course, there has to be content that will zero in on the sorts of issues where there is things that can be seen to be relevant and meaningful for young people's lives. The next section suggests that a lot of attention had been given to the development of personal faith through religious education, starting in the 1970s and coming on very strongly in the 80s after the publication of James Fowler's book on faith development. And I think that the word faith development, in my opinion, seemed to be counterproductive because it put more attention onto trying to change the faith of pupils rather than on educating them spiritually and religiously. And I now see that the word faith formation, which follows on from that, is more of a recent buzzword along with Catholic identity. And elsewhere, some attention has been given to potential problems with excessive emphasis on those constructs, because they tend to shift the focus to give an impression that the activity is more an ecclesiastical than an educational one. And I think that's talked about extensively elsewhere, so there's no need to go further with that, but I would identify that as one of the really key issues for the future of Catholic school religious education. The next section in the discussion looks at the way that diocesan guidelines for religious education developed, and one of my concerns about this was the amount of attention given to the development of guidelines and not enough attention given to the development of student resources. And I think that since these criticisms were first aired in the late 1990s, that there had been, particularly with the development of To Know, Worship and Love, and also if you look at the various Catholic diocesan websites, a lot of them have a lot of good material that is there that supports the teaching of religion. My concern though still is that I think Catholic diocesan religion syllabuses are too tame. To my way of thinking, I think they look too much like mini seminary courses that are concerned relatively exclusively with conserving the Catholic tradition rather than being more outwardly oriented towards what's happening outside as well. So I would like to see a curriculum that still gives core attention to the Catholic tradition, but also some attention to other traditions and also to the interpretation, the critical interpretation of the spiritual and moral issues of our day. And again, this is a topic that's taken up in more detail elsewhere. A few comments are made in the text here about the impact of the new studies of religion or religion studies courses and the quest for an academic credibility for Catholic school religious education. And I think I need not say too much more about that here, but just to note that these courses, when they came in to years 11 and 12, did increase the academic credibility of religious education, and some of that academic credibility flowed back down through the curriculum to junior secondary and even into primary. And the argument that I would propose would be that religion, the study of Catholic traditions in religious education, needs to be academic from day one in year one, right through to year 12. Of course, this is going to mean something different depending on the age and year level of the students, so that in those early years it should be a very hands-on, very concrete, very experiential approach with the more studious, more research-oriented and more intellectual things coming in as they move into the secondary areas. But I think that if that academic credibility is not there, then there is always going to be, it is always going to suffer, and is always going to be prone to being regarded as of little consequence. I've mentioned something about the use of student materials because I think that is really crucial. If you have good materials, then it is easier for the teachers to work with the students and have a religious education that is academic and informative. The, not so much a theme, but the final consideration that I'd like you to have a look at in the text points out that if you don't have some realistic understanding of the relatively secular spirituality of many of the students in Catholic schools, and of the life and spiritual issues that they are facing as they are trying to negotiate their way in life through what is like a cultural maze, which is increasingly making them feel pessimistic and alienated and so on, that if we don't take that into account, then I think there is a danger that religious education can be perceived even more by the students as just ecclesiastical and of no consequence. I think that religion is a subject area, that the serious systematic study of religion and other issues can make a really valuable contribution to the personal and spiritual education of young people today, over and above its a capacity to acquaint them and familiarise them with the Catholic religious tradition. That's not in question, but if this other dimension can be followed through, I think it would be particularly helpful. The final comments in the text are some further reflections about this need to make Catholic school religious education more personal and more meaningful and relevant to the lives of students. So there are some general concluding comments that I'd like you to have a look at because they complement the points that we've made in the discussion here. And you'll see that one of the suggestions made there is that in addition to looking at the Catholic religious tradition very carefully and systematically, that part of the dealing with life of students could involve looking at issue-oriented topics in religious education that relate to theology and critiques of religion, science and religion, world religions, and so on. So there are a number of topics suggested there. So this has been a relatively lengthy and engaging, well, time-consuming topic, and I don't expect that you will have had time necessarily to follow up on all the readings, but I hope you would follow up on those that you found of interest. And I hope that what the section does is help give you a perspective on how and why things have changed so much since the catechism days of the 1950s. And I end up with those two comments that are found on the flagstones outside the National Archives building in the United States in Washington, D.C., where it says something about the great importance of a knowledge of the past and of what happens as something that will be the best starting point for progressing meaningfully into the future. And the two quotations from those stones are as follows. The first one, "The past is the seed that brings forth the harvest of the future." I guess a bit emotional and sentimental, but I think it cashes in on that idea that it is knowledge of the past that can be very significant for charting a more meaningful path into the future in an area like this. And also, "The past is prologue," as if we need to know all of that before we start thinking about where we're going in the future.